Chapter 8.
Kasan Kadyrov calmed his nerves by concentrating on the hissing of his self-contained breathing apparatus. He'd been told that the characteristic sound of an SCBA had inspired the SFX for Darth Vader. He believed it. This was the kind of work that should be performed in a high-tech lab, not in this converted barn in Blanton, Tennessee, in the middle of rural nowhere. The ventilation hood should be a carefully engineered machine, purpose-built for handling such a deadly material, not this Frankenstein contraption that he'd slapped together from parts ordered online. Yet, here he was, making the best of what was available. He forced himself to concentrate on the containers he was manipulating under the chemical hood. The special product had arrived just a few days ago, after 15 weeks of endless waiting. And now Timur Yamadayev was screaming for a fast turnaround. Wait, 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 then hurry, hurry, hurry. All while being ejected from their house by two little boys and the thugs who were protecting them. Something clearly had gone wrong, but the details were none of his concern, especially not now. Shoulder to shoulder with his twin brother, Aslan, he went through the motions that they had practiced so many times that they seemed natural, drilled into muscle memory. Only now it was real, and the tiniest mistake could spell the worst kind of disaster. All of those practice runs had involved inert liquids, water mostly, but now they were playing for keeps. He'd studied chemistry at the university, and he'd trained for high-hazard chemical storage and deployment at the training camp in Yemen, so he understood the risks. The tiniest drop on the skin or in the eyes, or even a few molecules in the lungs, would result in a painful, awful death. Some people would take longer to die than others, but except for those with the smallest exposures, death was 90% assured. The special product, the VX, had arrived in the middle of the night via helicopter less than a week ago in containers that reminded Kasan of plastic beer kegs. They had received only 3, but had been expecting many more. How many, he didn't know. But they'd outfitted this barn to hold at least 20 containers this size. Aslan's job was to control the flow of the product from the shipping container, while Kasan monitored the Nalgene bottles that they would use to deploy the agent when the time came, a time that was ticking down to just a day or two from now. They wore identical blue Level A protective suits, moon suits in the parlance of the hazardous materials business. Kasan thought of them as body bags with windows. There could be no spillage. He'd learned to deal with the lack of tactile input through 3 layers of gloves, and his brain had learned to make sense of the images he saw, distorted as they were, first by the suit's built-in mask, and then by the mask of the breathing apparatus. The real concern for him right here, right now, was controlling the rush of knowing that this time the product was real. Once the deployment containers were filled, there were 3 of them, each holding a liter of agent. They had to be fitted into the dispensers in a manner that ensured a flawless seal. Of the hundreds, or perhaps thousands, of people these devices were designed to kill, he did not want to number himself or his brother among them. "Approaching the field level," Kasan said into the microphone of his radio set. "In 3, 2, 1, stop." Aslan cranked the valve closed, and the heavy, dark yellow liquid stopped flowing. "Are you ready for me to purge the line?" Aslan asked. "Stand by, one," Kasan said. Moving with deliberate precision, he removed the tubing from the fill port on the deployment bottle and shifted it carefully to an empty Nalgene container that he'd fitted previously with a scrubbed and vented seal. "Yes, purge the line." Aslan opened the cock on an elevated bottle of purging liquid, a mixture of denatured alcohol and liquid chlorine. The intent was to make sure that the trace amounts of agent remaining in the fill tubing would be purged and neutralized. Meanwhile, Kasan finished the process of sealing the deployment vessels. That done, he transferred them one at a time to the other end of the long workbench, then placed them inside a large glass aquarium where Templeton the Rat was scurrying about. When the containers were set, he pressed a cover over the top of the whole assembly. Templeton would be just fine if the containers were clean. If they were not, well, Templeton was a barn rat, named by Aslan after one of his favorite cartoon characters, one of the few they had watched while growing up in Chechnya. This entire apparatus, from the ventilated bench to the handling procedures to the use of Templeton for leak detection, had been Kasan's brainchild. He had built it to specs that mimicked what he'd read from Soviet Army field manuals, but they did not have the Kremlin's budget. In theory, everything should work. In theory. Kasan was confident in his engineering abilities, but this was a game where failures stayed hidden until it was too late, and the penalties were unforgiving.
"Are you ready for decontamination?"
Kasan asked over the radio.
"Yes, I am,"
Aslan replied. His voice carried a tone of relief. These suits were hot. By the time the brothers were done, sweat had pooled in their gloves and boots. Underneath, what few clothes they wore were saturated with sweat. Decontamination procedures, decon, consisted of little more than an organized, choreographed shower. They walked toward the only door to the outside and opened it to reveal an 8x8-foot anteroom that housed three metal lockers that were identical to what you'd find in a high school hallway. Opposite the lockers was a large, high-flow shower. This is where they'd scrub away contaminants that they had no reason to believe were there. The zippers that encased them in their moon suits ran diagonally from their left hip to their right shoulder on the back side of the garment. The suits were heavy-duty things that required assistance to don or doff. Aslan would take the first shower. The hardest part of this exercise was granting the full 5 minutes for the decon rinse. It felt like a long time when you were the one under the water stream, but it felt like forever when you were killing time waiting for your brother to finish. When Aslan was done, Kasan wrestled his brother's zipper down to extricate himself from the garment, and then took his place under the water stream. 5 minutes later, he turned the water off and stepped back into the locker room, where Aslan was waiting to open him up. Kasan pulled his arms free from the gloves and sleeves, then quick-marched free of the boots and hung the dripping suit up on the hanger next to the one Aslan had just hung up. Now clothed only in his underwear and breathing apparatus, Kasan stepped out into the chilly sunshine. The chill against his flesh felt refreshing as he turned off his air bottle and pulled the mask off his face. The air smelled of autumn.
"Well, we did it,"
Aslan said. He sat in a green and white lattice-webbed folding garden chair, clad in tighty-whities and a wife-beater.
"We did step one, anyway,"
Kasan agreed. He shrugged out of the SCBA harness and hung the rig in its designated plastic box on the outside wall of the converted barn.
"Step two is still a big if,"
he laughed when he got a full view of his brother.
"You look like shit. You should see a mirror."
The eldest of the pair by 4 minutes, Aslan was literally Kasan's mirror image. Left-handed instead of right, hair parted on the right instead of the left, they'd soon be 26 years old. The ladies seemed to find them attractive, though for the life of him, Kasan couldn't understand why. When he looked at his reflection, either a glass one or the living one, he couldn't see past the large ethnic Chechen nose and tangled hair. Today, right now, make that matted hair.
"Why is step two a big if? You mean the deployment? The problem, Kassan explained in the patient tone that often pissed Aslan off as sounding condescending, is that we've only tested it with water. Now that I know what the special product really is, the X, I realize that we've tested for the wrong viscosity. Water is only 5 centipoise maximum, maybe less. The special product is like 10 centipoise.
The laboratory slash barn sat atop a hill behind the farmhouse from which they'd been banished. Their home since they'd arrived in the United States. The 80-acre spread gave them the privacy they needed to do the jobs they needed to do. In this part of Tennessee, no one questioned the regular gunfire on their private range. No one saw the assembled stacks of food and water. Nor did anyone raise a stink when deliveries were made by helicopter during the darkest hours of moonless nights.
Aslan said, "If you want me to say you're smarter than me, again, I'm fine with that. Now, what the hell does all of that mean, and why do we care?"
"The VX is thicker," Kassan said, "more like kerosene than water. I don't know how that might affect the performance of the dispenser."
"Can it really make that much of a difference?"
"I don't know. That's the point. We get one shot for this thing to do the maximum possible damage, and we have no idea how it's going to perform."
Kassan helped himself to a second folding lawn chair. His was blue and white.
"So, what's your solution?" Aslan asked.
It felt strange to articulate the thought that had been rattling in his head for the past couple of days.
"We need to test it with the real product."
Aslan's jaw dropped.
"With the VX?"
"We have to."
"But how? We don't have enough of it as it is."
Kassan dismissed the concern.
"We have as much as we have," he said. "If the apparatus works, it will be plenty to make a big impact. I don't think it will make that big a difference if we kill 1,000 people or 2,000. Either way, I think America will get the point."
"But how do you test nerve gas? I mean, who are you going to gas?"
"It's not who," Kassan said. "It's what. Let's see how Templeton is doing."
Kassan rose from his folding chair and headed back toward the lab, pausing at the door to slip his feet into the tennis shoes he'd left there while on his way in to get dressed. There was no need at this point to climb back into the moon suit. Aslan got up too.
"How long are we going to be kicked out of our house anyway?"
Kassan smiled.
"First of all, it's not our house. Unless you signed a deed I don't know about."
He looked back and saw that his brother was likewise, smiling.
"We go back when Timur says we can go back. Welcome to life as a soldier."
When the kids arrived, the Kadyrov brothers had been pushed out to a smaller cabin that sat on the top of the same hill with the barn. It was furnished, and it had a well, plus it also had electricity, thanks to its proximity to the lab.
"Why are they even here?"
Aslan asked as they stepped into the locker area.
"Because Timur wants them here."
Kassan worried sometimes about his brother's insistence on questioning everything.
"No air packs," Aslan said as they neared the inner door. "I just need to get close enough to see if your pet rodent is still wandering around,"
Kassan replied.
"If he is, we're good. If not, well, I'm not sure what we are."
Kassan kept his feet on the locker room side of the door as he leaned in through the opening and waited for his eyes to adjust.
"What do you see?"
Aslan asked from behind him.
"Movement," Kassan replied. "I'm going in to take a closer look."
"Are you sure you don't want to pack up?"
Again with the questions.
"If Templeton is alive inside a closed container with the dispensers, then we should be fine out here."
Aslan hesitated at the door.
"We're not going to deploy these things wearing moon suits," Kassan said. Now's as good a time as any to get used to handling them barehanded. Kassan had no expectation that he would ever see Chechnya again. He accepted that he would likely die violently. But it would not be here in a barn, and it would not be on his first operation. When they deployed the dispensers, the event would be the first of its kind. No one would be expecting it. Complacency and soft targets were his dream. Their second mission, whatever that might be, would be dicier, because number two would establish a pattern, and then the third mission would likely be the one that would kill them. You could try to be careful, and you could be mindful of repeating patterns, but the police had resources at their disposal that he could only begin to imagine. Even if you didn't make a mistake, you couldn't guarantee that a fleck of dry skin might not slough off or that a hair wouldn't fall onto the crime scene. After half an hour alone in the glass case, Templeton looked perfectly healthy, if a bit harried by his incarceration. Kassan walked the 15 feet across the lab space to parole their furry friend. He lifted the rodent out of the aquarium and placed him on the work table, where he could decide for himself where to go next. "Are you ready, Aslan?" His twin materialized on his left.
"Ready for what?"
"We're going to take this one out and test it. See if it works."
"And how are we going to do that?"
"Cows," Kassan said. A 3-foot-long roll of bubble wrap hung from the wall behind the table. He pulled off a 2-foot length and cut it free with the box cutter that sat there for that purpose.
"Where are you going to find cows?"
"You're kidding, right?
Where can't you find cows around here?"
Kassan lifted the dispenser assembly out of the aquarium and set it atop the spread of bubble wrap. He lifted the bubble wrap up and around the assembly and held it together while his brother sealed the edges with a strip of packing tape. They were ready to go. The prison house looked bigger from the front yard than it did from the inside. A black chain-link fence surrounded a small yard. Ryder wasn't good at judging distances, but to his eye it looked about 50 yards square, about the distance he had to run for gym class tests. The fence was tall, over twice as tall as Ryder, and he'd topped 5'5" this year. It looked kind of like chain link, but the wire was much thicker, maybe a 1/4 inch in diameter. There'd be no cutting through this sucker a la The Great Escape. The fence itself didn't wrap around the whole house, but rather around the back and side yards, like you'd build to keep a nasty dog away from visitors when they approached the front door. The wire along the top, what they'd been told was razor wire, was good old barbed wire, just like every other fence along every other road, and if there were sensors, he didn't see any wires for them. He hadn't walked the entire fence line yet, but he'd get to it. It wasn't like there was a lot else to do. Officer Al told them that they needed some exercise and then announced that he had to take off for a while. That would leave them alone with Officer Kim, and Ryder was more than happy to be as far away from that psycho as he could be. The guy stared at them all the time. He barely even blinked. It was creepy, made creepier still by that big red splotch that covered his left eye, a port wine stain. Jimmy Grady at school had one of those, only his didn't make him look crazy. Ryder watched as Officer Al exited the front door and walked to the old Ford pickup that was parked sideways in the front yard on the other side of the fence. It was smaller than most pickups and was painted the color of moss.
"He's not wearing his uniform," Jeff said.
Captain Obvious strikes again.
"That's because he's not really a cop," Ryder said.
Officer Al opened the truck's door and slipped in behind the steering wheel. He tipped down the visor with his right hand, and with his left he caught the keys that dropped down.
"I didn't think so," They're too mean.
The engine turned and caught. Officer Owl slung an arm over the seat, backed out 10 feet, then ground the transmission into gear before driving down the gravel driveway ahead of a gray cloud of dust.
"Who are they, then?"
Jeff asked. He held a filthy soccer ball in both hands, the focus of their forced recreation.
"I don't know. Kidnappers, I think."
Jeff's face lost all expression.
"We've been kidnapped? They put us in the trunk of a friggin' car, doofus."
Ryder took the ball away and walked toward the center of the yard.
"Stay there. I'll pass it to you."
He walked less than 20 feet, then turned and dropped the ball onto the grass. He tapped the pass, nothing aggressive. Jeff trapped the ball and passed it back.
"Is Dad dead?"
Ryder stayed focused on the ball.
"I'm not sure," he said. "You're lying." "If you're so sure I'm lying, then you must think you already know."
Ryder didn't want to talk about this. The way the arrest had gone down the other night, Jeff had slept through the whole thing. If only Ryder could have been so lucky. When the soccer ball came back to him, he chipped it into the air, setting up a header for Jeff.
"I think I heard shooting,"
Jeff said.
"I know I smelled gunpowder, and Mom was crying."
He let the ball bounce on the ground, then settled it with his chest before chipping it back to Ryder.
"But the way they took me out, they didn't let me see anything."
So Jeff hadn't slept through it after all.
"They didn't let me see anything either. But, goddammit, I wish I hadn't seen it on my own."
He let the ball bounce off the crown of his head, caught it with his thigh, then juggled it from knee to knee. Ryder had awakened at the sound of people moving around outside the house. When he peeked out his window, he saw men in black uniforms with their helmets and guns. He bumped the ball high off his knee, then headed it back to Jeff. When Jeff got the ball, he grounded it with his foot.
"Is he dead?"
Ryder felt emotion rising.
"Why don't you just let it go? Why don't you just tell me? Stop being such an asshole!"
Sadness morphed into anger. There was too much shit in Ryder's life now to put up with Jeff talking to him that way. He took a menacing step toward his little brother, a move he'd made thousands of times over the years. But rather than backing away, Jeff took a step forward, daring him to engage.
"Are we really going to fight?"
Jeff challenged. His fists were clenched. Ryder was stunned.
Yes, he thought. Yes, he wanted to fight. He wanted to hit someone. But no, this was not the way to vent. And Jeff wasn't really the person he wanted to hit anyway.
Yes, Ryder said.
I think Dad is dead.
He watched his brother for a reaction and was surprised when he didn't get much of one. Jeff's fists opened and his shoulders sagged.
What about Mom?
Ryder looked at the ground.
I don't know. I think she's still alive, but I don't know. Why did the police come in the first place?
Jeff walked to the soccer ball and tapped it back to his brother. Ryder trapped it with the sole of his foot.
I don't know. I think it had something to do with drugs. After Dad stopped working, I think I heard them talking about stuff.
He rolled the ball a few times on its axis with his toes, then kicked it as hard as he could into the yard.
Shit!
Tears erupted out of nowhere, and then he was even more pissed. He whirled away from Jeff and swiped at his eyes. Snot was dripping, too.
God damn it!
He felt Jeff's hand on his back.
We'll be okay.
Ryder turned to face him.
To hell with the tears. Let him see them.
No, we won't, he said.
He lowered his voice and pulled Jeff farther away from the cabin.
None of this is right, Jeffy. These guys are killers. They killed a priest, for Christ's sake. A priest! Instant ticket to hell. And the lady who was driving us. If they'll do that...
His voice trailed off because he didn't know how to complete the sentence.
They're not going to hurt us, Jeff said. Al said so. All we have to do is obey the rules, and they'll still kill us. A priest, Jeff. A priest.
Jeff shot a nervous look back over his shoulder toward the cabin.
That doesn't mean they'll hurt us.
Ryder tossed up his arms. Was Jeff really so stupid that he couldn't see it? Couldn't see that Al and Kim had no choice but to kill them?
We witnessed the murders, he whispered. That's a death penalty offense. And you know what? So is kidnapping. We have to get away from here, away from them.
Another panicked look back toward the cabin.
Could you be more obvious?
Ryder snapped. Quit doing that.
There's no way, Jeff said. If we try to get away, they'll kill us.
They'll kill us anyway. Jeff's expression changed as he looked at something over Ryder's shoulder. He showed curiosity and humor.
Who are they?
He pointed. At first, Ryder couldn't see what he was pointing at. Then, when he did, he laughed. Two guys up on the crest of the hill were hanging out in their underwear.
How gay is that?
What are they doing?
Jeff asked.
How the hell would I know? Comparing dick sizes?
That made Jeff laugh. It was a good sound to hear.
Hey!
A voice called from the cabin. It was Officer Kim, the psychopath.
What are you two talking about?
Nothing,
they answered in unison.
Bullshit! Get over here!
Kim pointed to a spot at his feet.
Don't say anything,
Ryder instructed.
About what?
About anything.
Kim shouted.
Now!
The two boys walked together, stopped about 10 feet short of Kim.
Tell me what you were talking about,
Kim said. When the boys stood silently, he said,
What? Are you afraid of me?
Yeah. Ryder was terrified of him, but he wasn't going to give him the satisfaction of showing it. He locked his jaw.
Big brother. Tough little man, eh?
Kim baited. He took a step forward and leaned in until his face was level with Ryder's and only a foot or so away. He smelled like sweat and onions.
You want to do battle with me, kid? You want to take a shot at me? Throw a punch?
Ryder forced himself not to blink. This day, these days, were shitty enough without adding any of this to the mix. He wasn't going to fight a man who no doubt could turn him inside out, but he wasn't going to back down either. He was in too deep for that now.
One way or the other. You're going to answer my question,
Kim said.
We were wondering whether or not our parents are dead,
Jeff said.
We know our dad is, but we don't know about our mom.
Kim continued to glare at Ryder as he said,
And what did you decide?
We think that mom is still alive.
Jeff said. Then after a beat,
Is she?
You better hope she is.
Why do you say,
Shut up, Jeff,
Ryder said. He's enjoying it too much. Ryder never saw the backhand coming, looping in from his blind side. It hit him full on the cheek and pirouetted him down to the grass.
That I enjoyed,
Kim said.
Talking, not so much.
Ryder sat up and brought one hand to his face, while the other side went to his nose to check for the blood that he could smell in his sinuses. He was surprised not to find any. Kim moved his forefinger from one of their faces to the other, as if pivoting on a turret.
"You behave yourselves, boys, or I swear to God I will hurt you."
Then he turned on his heel and went back inside.
"Don't worry about him," Jeff said, stooping to help Ryder to his feet. "He's just a bully."
Ryder shook off the assistants. "I can get myself up." He rose first to his knees and then got his feet under him, brushing the grass and dirt from his backside.
"I'll go get the ball,"
Jeff said, and he jogged off in that direction.
"I don't want to play anymore," Ryder said.
Jeff either didn't hear him or just chose to ignore him, probably some of each. They were getting away from here. Ryder didn't know much about a lot of things, but that was one thing he was 100% sure of, and he had to take Jeff with him.